One of my favorite things about working as an emergency vet is that I don't need to deal with all those tricky long-term diseases, like Cushing's. Sometimes I do get to do the fun part of starting the investigation, but once we've stabilized whatever they came in for and we're on a path of finding an answer, the real work of confirming a diagnosis and managing the disease begins with you guys, my general practitioner heroes. And man, oh man, can Cushing's be tricky. Even just diagnosing it can be a real challenge. Managing it well, that's a whole different story. But then we did this interview over on our clinical podcasts, and now I'm a little bit sad that I don't get to be involved with hyper-A cases anymore. Because after listening to Dr. Sue unpack hyperadrenocorticism and all of its sneaky tricks in such a systematic way, I feel like I could totally take it on and make a big difference to these patients. Like, come here, you big fat adrenals. I'm going to shrink you right down. So who is Dr. Sue in the zoo? Dr. Sue Foster is a registered specialist in feline medicine and a senior lecturer in small animal medicine at Murdoch University in Western Australia. She's also an internal medicine consultant for Vetnostics and ASAP Laboratories. And as you'll hear during this conversation, in this role, she looks at a lot of Cushing's testing results and has probably helped to diagnose and manage more Cushing's cases than you've expressed anal glands. And that's even if you counted the left and the right glands separately. Basically, you're in good hands with this conversation, in which Dr. Sue takes on the belief that Cushing's disease is not that bad a disease, and that we don't really have to always treat it. She clues us into all these subtle ways that Cushing's can present that you might not pick up both clinically and on bloods. And of course, we get real deep on what Dr. Sue does day in and day out. Those slippery cortisol stimulation tests, which hopefully, after this episode, will feel a lot less slippery. Sue also presents a paradigm shift in how we think about treating these cases. I don't want to spoil it for you, but basically, go out there and treat it like you mean it. This episode was originally produced for the VetVault Clinical Medicine podcast series, but we're sharing it far and wide thanks to the support of our friends at the SVS Pathology Network. If you're an Aussie practitioner, you'll know them as Vetnostics, VetPath, ASAP Laboratory, and QML Vetnostics, depending on where you are. And if you're not from these parts, well, then I'm sorry, you're missing out. As you'll hear from this conversation, all lab tests are not created equal. And when the repercussions of your results can make a huge impact on the patient in front of you, you want to be very sure that the people doing your diagnostics are using the best that science has to offer. So it's good to know that the SVS Pathology Network lab that you use is doing just that. And they're not just spitting a bunch of numbers out and leaving you to figure out what they mean. They have people like Dr. Sue and other internal medicine consultants on the other end interpreting your results to support your clinical decision making. Okay, jump in, enjoy, and then get back out there and go and make a real difference to these cases. Dr. Sue Foster, welcome to the VetVault podcast.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Cushing's. We're digging into Cushing's. Cushing's is pretty much your life now, right?
Well, it does seem to be my life. I'm not sure that's what I planned, but case numbers dictate that most of my day is spent on Cushing's, yes.
So explain your role. So you work for Vetnostics as a medical consultant. Does that mean us GPs call you when we don't understand our test results? Or like, how exactly are you involved with Cushing's specifically so much?
In the morning, all the cortisol results that have come in overnight get put out by an internist rather than a pathologist. So we actually get to comment on those results and to look back and see what results have come previous, how dogs have presented, have they been diagnosed correctly, is there any doubt, what's the treatment, how are they responding to treatment. So we comment on, I guess, diagnosis and treatment of Cushing's syndrome and Addison's.
So it's adrenal disease in general. So it's all the. So sorry, if that keeps you busy full time, how many are you seeing? Like, how many adrenal function tests does this one lab deal with in an average year?
That's a very good question. I probably comment on upwards of 5,000, I suppose.
Whoa. Okay. So this is looking at the results, looking at the history, and then trying to help the GP make sense of what does it actually mean. So in other words, A, have you got your diagnosis that you're looking for? If not, suggestions sort of what else to do, or it's on treatment and yeah, your treatment's good or no. fiddle with your treatment.
Yeah, that's correct. So we do the validations, and then vets can ring up during the day and discuss treatments, diagnostics, what to do.
Okay. And mostly the stim test or low dose dex, or like percentage wise, what are you seeing when we're focusing on Cushing specifically?
When we're focusing on Cushing's for diagnosis, I guess the majority of tests that come in are ACTH stim tests, yes.
What do you think about that? Is that in your opinion, is that the test that we should be doing?
Well, historically, the low-dose DEX test has been regarded as the most sensitive test, but of course, it's the least specific test. So if you're going to get a false positive, it's more likely on a low-dose DEX test. So in many ways, it's quite a good idea for an ACTH stim test to be run in practice so that you don't get so many false positive diagnoses. The other thing is that some of that historical data with different assays doesn't really probably apply in the Australian situation. So I think our ACTH stim test, especially set at the cutoffs we have at Vetnostics, is reasonably sensitive, probably much better than the historical reported sensitivities for the ACTH stim test.
So sorry, how is it different in Australia? Are we doing the test differently, or what's...
We have a totally different dog population. So unlike any other dog population in the world, our predominant breed is Maltese. We also have a million Staffies and Australian cattle dogs, and sure, the oodles and poodles. But if you look historically, it's been the poodles and Daxies and those sorts of breeds. So they've had quite a different breed list. So I do wonder whether the sensitivity of these tests is breed dependent. I mean, I've pulled a heap of data on discrepant tests, but of course I haven't had time to go through it. But I've probably got 1,000 tests that I need to actually look through to see whether, tease out if there are any breed differences. Because historically, for example, Ed Feldman in the US always supported the low-dose DEX test, but his average-sized dog in his population is 19 to 20 kilos. That's very different from the Australian dog population, which is somewhere between averages between 5 and 7 kilos.
So why does that matter when we're talking about Cushing's disease?
Well, Cushing's syndrome, I guess, is more than one disease. And we don't really have a full understanding of all the different types of Cushing's, if you like. I mean, there's, in broad terms, there's iatrogenic, pituitary dependent, and adrenal dependent. But for example, in Scottish Terriers, they've shown that it may be a decreased clearance of cortisol that's actually contributing to Cushing's in that breed.
Don't we, the point of these podcasts is to make these things simpler, Sue, not to
complicate. I know. Nothing gets simple with Cushing's, I'm sorry. But I think we've always looked at dog population as a whole. And I think we know that that isn't really the case. And so it is possible that ACTH stim test sensitivity may vary in different populations. It's just a hypothesis. Really, I don't know. But that's one thing. The other thing is that really most commercial laboratories, if not all apart from us, don't validate their own assay. So they use quite high cutoffs for an ACTH stimulation test. And they use historical textbook cutoffs. They don't use their own validated cutoffs. And we actually use a reference interval that was validated for healthy dogs in the lab. So that put us in a fairly unique position.
So by validating, just to clarify, you mean you ran the test on a bunch of dogs that showed none of the symptoms of the Cushing syndrome and went, well, these are cutoffs for normals and then anything above that. So you guys made your own range based on your test and on the local population.
We didn't actually have to make our own reference interval, because what we did was, back when Nick Russell looked at the Immulite assay, we collected a whole lot of cortisols and compared radio immunoassays, which are now gone, which were the gold standard at Sydney Uni, and we looked at Immulite against CoTeCount, RIA, and we found quite big differences. But then when we ran the Vetnostics assay, which is quite a different assay from the Immulite, they were interchangeable. So it actually meant we were really lucky, and we could use the very, very well validated and established Sydney Uni reference intervals for their radio immunoassay. because we didn't have to do it. Otherwise, you couldn't really do it. It's the sort of thing that university reference labs could do because they had extensive workups to prove or disprove Cushing's, and then that figured into their reference intervals. But you can't really do that with a commercial lab. The only way was comparing to a gold standard assay. And as it happened, the Advia Centaur assay at the time, and now Atelica, just happened to be virtually identical with the code count.
So just to clarify on the choice of test then, so my understanding from a previous discussion was that, exactly as you say, ACTH system is great when it's positive because it means that it is.
Yes.
But there's that iffy gray zone that us GPs hate so much. And certainly in Australian populations, I've had plenty of gray zone results over the years. And then the low-dose Dex is much more sensitive. So it's not going to give you that gray zone. If the dog has Cushing's, it's more likely to give you a positive test result, but it is more influenced by any other disease. Anything else that's wrong with the animal is going to mess with the low-dose Dex suppression test. So then you get those false positives much more likely. For that reason, our understanding was that low-dose Dex is probably the one to go for unless you've got a sick animal. But that was my takeaway. But you saying that you feel like ACTH system is straightforward enough that it's worth running?
I think that is very valid because I think that is helpful. I just think we see a lot of dogs that have a negative low-dose Dex test and they can stimulate to 1,000 nanomoles per liter. And vice versa, we see ACTH stims that go just into normal range, 200 nanomoles per liter, and they totally fail a low-dose Dex test and they do not have concurrent disease. You know, if I wanted to be really blunt about this, I would say what Carmel Mooney does is that Cushing's is a two-test disease and we shouldn't be worrying about the semantics of which is the most sensitive. We probably should just be, as you say, not running a low-dose Dex test in an ill dog and then start off with either test, really. It sort of doesn't matter. So long as if you think you have Cushing's, you follow up with a second. That would be my take-home message. ACTH stims, it depends which lab you're running them through as to how sensitive, because that grey zone really depends on how likely something is to have Cushing's or not, whereas we tend to look at what should happen in a healthy dog and then we compare it with the age, the breed, the clinical history the veterinarian has provided us with, and then put it together and say, on the basis of this, we think it is more likely that this is a true positive than a false positive, or we think it's more likely it's a false positive. So we don't actually put out grey zones. We interpret each on a pre-test probability situation.
Okay, cool. You say that's not, we have a lot of listeners from the UK and the US and all over. So that's not necessarily the case in a UK lab or something like that. And as you say, the dog populations are different.
No, and I think for many commercial laboratories, I think probably low-dose Dex test will be the most sensitive test. You know, it depends really where you fine-tuned your ACTH stim test as to how sensitive it is.
Okay, great. So when, over the years, from looking at all those results and taking all those phone calls, what are the most common stumbling blocks and questions that you get regarding Cushing's testing?
I guess the big stumbling blocks for most people is, I have a dog, it looks like it has Cushing's, but it doesn't have a high ALP, so it can't be Cushing's, right? Well, that's not the case. And likewise, I have a dog, it looks really Cushingoid, I'm sure it's got Cushing's, age, breed, everything right, but it's concentrating its urine. Do I have to test for it? And I really think we have to move away from historical 50-year-old data that said something had to be polydipsic or have a high ALP to have Cushing's. Probably they do when they're historically presenting, you know, with severe bilateral alopecia and belly dropping in the floor and tearing every cupboard down and drinking everything. But I think we can pick Cushing's a lot earlier than that. And I don't think it's a prerequisite that you need an increased ALP or a decreased urine-specific gravity. And I actually wish people would do more fasting triglycerides. I think that would be potentially far more interesting because we do those as routine. Well, we do triglycerides as routine. We can't guarantee they're fasted. That's not out of our control. And many Cushing's dogs will have an increased triglyceride regardless of their ALP or their USG.
You're right. So many, as in 80%, 90%, or I know, not asking for specific data, but your feel.
Yeah, that I can't say, because remember, a lot of people do in-house testing, and that doesn't come with triglycerides, and that's been done before I see the ACTH-DIM or the low-dose DEX test.
Okay, and that's not going to be to the level of visually seeing a lipemic sample. It's not like a pancreatitis blood sample.
Well, it may not cause lipemia. It depends on the degree of hypertriglyceridemia, but certainly, I mean, we're all used to plenty of Cushing's dogs do have those strawberry milkshake lipemic bloods.
Okay. And you're saying that you think that might actually be a good, fairly sensitive trigger or a clue to say, well, I've got high triglycerides. If I send an external blood screen off and it comes back with high triglyceride levels and I've got clinical signs as well, that might be a trigger for you to go, well, even if your ALP is not high, consider Cushing's testing.
I think if you have a consistent fasting hypertriglyceridemia, Cushing's has to be one of the differentials, even, and I dare say it, controversially in miniature schnauzers.
Because they have the, we sort of expect them to have it, right?
Yeah, they get written off as having primary hypertriglyceridemia, often without adrenal function testing. And I do believe they should get adrenal function testing, because primary hypertriglyceridemia is a diagnosis of exclusion.
So help me here, because we, in other discussions we've had as well, sort of said that Cushing's is a syndrome. So a high ALP or a stim test that's out of whack or anything else doesn't make a Cushing's patient if it's not showing the signs of, so the PUPD, the hair loss, all the things that we expect to see in Cushing's disease. Is that, that doesn't quite gel with what you're saying here, that, the, you know, let's say I've got a schnauzer, it gets a pre-J blood screen, or it's got something else wrong, we run bloods, it's got fatty blood, but nothing else, no alarm bells are going off for me that it looks or acts Cushingoid. Am I still going to investigate that, or is it okay to say, well, you're a schnauzer, you've got fat in your blood, so what?
Well, I guess I personally believe you should check for it, yes. It's quite difficult to manage primary hypertriglyceridemia in miniature schnauzers. It's difficult to get the trigs down. And those dogs can go on to have pretty miserable lives with recurrent pancreatitis, gallbladder mucosal, diabetes mellitus. And I see them through the lab. I pulled quite a few miniature schnauzer cases that came through and looked at the histories, which we get to do because we can often follow these dogs out for their lifetime. And those hypertriglyceridemic miniature schnauzers, some of them led pretty terrible lives. So if we can do something to really try and find an underlying cause and treat that, then it may give us a better chance of addressing the hypertriglyceridemia. So yes, I do think it's worth it in a miniature schnauzer. And of course, that flies in the face of really what everyone else thinks, but there was some fabulous work done by my colleagues, Troy Bunn in Australia and Catherine Langner and Gabrielle Rossi. They did an amazing research project with miniature schnauzers that has been presented at European Society of Veterinary Endocrinology and is now obviously either in press or in the process of going to publication.
I didn't intend to talk about fatty blood, but it's actually something that often does bother you in practice. So just to recap, you say a persistent hypertriglyceridemia will cause or can cause pancreatitis, we know, the risk for that. And did you say diabetes as well? Does it play into diabetes?
I think when dogs have many recurrent bouts of pancreatitis, diabetes is a possible end stage, yes, not diabetes directly.
And you mentioned a third thing?
Oh, they get a lot of gallbladder mucosals. I don't know whether it's to do with the trigs or it's to do with the untreated Cushing's, but regardless, they get it. And so they just have miserable lives. I mean, some of the dogs that we had through Vetnostics had, you know, 50 and 60 submissions for bloods for various illnesses over 4 or 5 years. And you just think, these poor people and
something's
these poor
wrong.
Dogs.
Yeah.
If
yeah,
we can
well.
Make anything better there. And we may not be able to, but I certainly some dogs that I personally have been involved with and we've treated actually with mitotane, so we've had very tight control of the hypertriglyceridemia. They have resolved, this is miniature schnauzers I'm talking about, they have resolved their hypertriglyceridemia, but it takes quite a few months.
Wow. And is it just the schnauzers? Do we ever get it I know I shouldn't ask ever because, yes, there's always always the outliers, but routinely, do we expect to see it sometimes in other breeds as well, or is it really just the schnauzers?
Oh, yes, there are some other breeds as well. Lippards aren't really my forte apart from, I mean, sort of Cushing's ears, lippards aren't, but Shelties ring a bell, but, you know, I honestly can't remember. There are a list of breeds that have been reported to have lippard abnormalities.
And just to put a point on it, this might be more of a pathologist question, because it often happens, you draw blood and then it is fatty or you get an abnormal result from the lab. How long since eating should it be until you can say, well, that's abnormal? Where do we draw the line to say you definitely shouldn't be having fatty blood by this stage of the game?
For most studies, we use 12-hour fasting. For our miniature schnauzers, we used 15. But I think realistically, most dogs don't have a huge postprandial spike. They'll have a bit, but not into the numbers that are going to be 12, 13, 14, 15 sort of numbers that we can see with some of these dogs. If they eat a big fatty shank bone or something, they might go up to 5. But I don't know, because really the work hasn't been done. But ideally, a 12-hour fast, if you had 8-hour, I guess that's probably pretty good. But if you were looking at it from a persistent level, you'd want fasting triglycerides of 12 hours or more.
Quick interruption to tell you about something semi-secret that we're planning. So in the last week of May, a lot of you might be hanging around in Adelaide for the AVA National Conference. We'll be hanging around there too, and we're planning something really fun. We are partnering with our friends from Vedi, the very clever guys who've figured out a way to link patient data to your patient's existing microchip. And we've booked a very funky venue right across the road from the conference where we will do live podcast recording with you guys as an audience and as possible participants and possibly have a drink or two together. And the reason I said that it's semi-secret is because we're not giving away any details or tickets or anything like that beforehand. You have to come and find us at the Vedi stand on the trade floor to get your ticket, at which point all will be revealed. Oh, the event is planned for Wednesday the 31st, which also happens to be my birthday. So that works out well. So make sure you come and find us on those first 3 days. Can't wait. Okay, back to overexcited adrenal glands with Dr. Sue. Just to go back to those two sticking points. So you said ALP not being up doesn't rule it out, which I'm like, no, really? I feel like it should. I would be very uncomfortable chasing Cushing's if I don't have ALP up. And you said, no, not necessarily. You can see them with normal ALP.
Yeah, most definitely. And I guess if you look at the calls I get, they're skewed to the ones that don't match the textbook. So, again, and this is where the problem is in cases being potentially overrepresented in my consult load as opposed to what happens out there, because things with an outfoss increase are far simpler. So it's if it doesn't increase that people often call me. So I would see a higher number of them relative to what's really happening out there. But, yeah, sure. Again, I wonder if it's a breed thing. It's unusual to see a Maltese, for example, that has a normal outfoss, and probably subjectively more of my large breed dogs don't have the outfoss increase. But that's a really subjective comment. You know, I sit on all this data, but I need a resident to actually look through it all, really.
Oh, that's why I love these discussions, though, because we all know that there are limitations to what research has and hasn't been done. And it's nice to speak to people who do it all the time. We have a feel for it, and we'll put it in there and say, well, look, it doesn't mean it's a fact, it's not proven, but we're talking to somebody who looks at 5,000 a year. You should probably have a better feel for it than any of us. So I think it's a valid thing. And then the concentrated urine, I just want to double click on that, because again, when I went through uni, it was taught under the banner, Cushing's disease was taught under the banner of diseases that cause BUPD. That was sort of the primary thing that's going to trigger you to start looking for it is BUPD, which you would expect a minimally concentrated urine. And I've learned in the last 5 years, no, not necessarily the case, correct?
Yeah, correct. And I don't know that it ever has been. Again, it was this lovely textbook package that came with it. But if you looked at the early studies, the studies back in the 80s, there was always an 80 to 85% polydipsia rate. That meant 15 to 20% weren't. And it was unlikely that those 15 to 20% also would have a dilute USG. So I think it's been there, but it's we've concentrated so heavily on Cushing's being a differential diagnosis for polydipsia that we forget that Cushing's can present without polydipsia. And a very long time ago, there was a study in, I think, vet dermatology, where the dermatologist said, well, our cases don't conform to that. And of course they didn't, because the dermatologists were getting the cases that weren't automatically identifiable in primary practice because they weren't polydipsic. So they were far, a bit like my ALPs, they were far more likely to get referrals of skin diseases because there was no polydipsia and people hadn't chased the Cushing syndrome in them. So because it's a syndrome, all those things do not have to be in place for it to be Cushing's. And that would be my real take-home message. We have dogs that have just skin disease. We have dogs that present with calcium oxalate urolith as their only sign. And the schnauzers, for example, never become alopecic. Even when they have PU, PD, polyphagia, ALP and whatever, you can, their coat changes a little bit and you get used to picking that change, but they never present as that textbook bilateral alopecia. I've never seen a completely alopecic miniature schnauzer. So they just don't present that way.
Such a multifactorial syndrome, right? Like the more I do these podcasts, every now and again we'll do an episode on something and then it will be mentioned as, oh, and don't forget about Cushing's because that's going to mess with your results. So I want to try and recap, try and put these into one place. So let's talk about the syndrome. So there's the classic one. It's the pot-bellied dog that eats and drinks a lot and pants all day and has coat changes. The classic. Yeah, you walk through the door and I go, yeah, I know what you've got. that's the easy. But then the more sneaky things that we might miss for the one, especially as you say, as we get better and better at picking this up and we don't let them get to that extreme, very obvious Cushingoid stage. Calcium oxalate, that's a new one to me. Calcium oxalate crystals with Cushing's. How does that
calcium work? Oxalate uroliths, not just crystals. Excess corticosteroids cause increased excretion of calcium. That's why we use prednisolone as one modality to treat hypercalcemia, to try and increase the urinary excretion of that. And that's an old one that's tucked away in the first edition of Feldman and Nelson.
What other sneaky things are there that are not the typical ones? What do we see clinically? And then maybe on bloods as well, bloods or let's say general testing beyond ALP.
Yeah. I think the failure to regrow after the cruciate surgery is a big one, failure to regrow hair. A cruciate ligament rupture, of course, is something that can occur when you have excess corticosteroids and hypercortisolism. So when we get older dogs with cruciate ligaments, we should, just like we do for polydipsia, have Cushing's there in the DDX list, and we don't. You see them 3 months or 4 months later for their vaccination and they still haven't really regrown their hair over that surgery site. That's a real red flag. And, for example, you were talking about subtle Cushing's, but in Australia with Australian cattle dogs, for example, like the schnauzers, they never, ever present with alopecia. I've never seen one present with alopecia. But they do get a lot of cruciate rupture, and one of the main reasons they get picked up is the failure to regrow hair over that site. Now, when you look at them, yeah, sure, they're panting a little bit more. They may or may not be drinking more. But really, one of the first signs in that breed can be their cruciate rupture and the failure to regrow.
And they're tricky because they're kind of barrel-shaped anyway. Like a normal, no, I'm serious, a normal cattle dog have that they hairy and bluntly round. So it would take a while for them to get pot-bellied to the point where you go, oh, you're actually abnormal.
Well, it's interesting. I had a very high-level military nurse come in with her Australian cattle dog many years ago, and her complaint was the dog's weight hadn't changed, but she was pretty sure that the body shape had changed. Now, we're talking about a very observant, highly intelligent and very keen pet owner, and what she'd noticed was that the dog used to have a lovely tucked-up belly, and now it was the same weight, but it was almost a flat line. You know, I use that dog in lectures routinely because if you looked at it, it had a slightly singed hair coat around the collar region and in the interscapular region. It just looked a little bit browny on a blue cattle dog, and it had the flat belly as opposed to a tucked up belly that the dog had always had, and it panted on a winter's day. And so it's sort of lovely, but and it induced very quickly with Mitotane in those days. And everything resolved. So textbook wise, you never would have treated that dog, but this was an owner who wanted the best for that dog. And in the days of my detainer, it was a slightly scary proposition, but this was a dog that really you would not pick as having Cushing's. And should you treat it, of course, because again, the prevailing dogma has been don't treat till you get clinical signs. But there was a study in JSAP in 2016, and 26% of those dogs died of their hypercortisolism. If there were other complications, for example, if you included things like pancreatitis, etc., up to 32% of dogs actually died from sequelae or directly from hypercortisolism. So
directly how? I get it if you get an infection and you can't fight it or you're not healing. But how does hypercortisolism kill you directly?
Pulmonary thromboembolism, overwhelming infections, pancreatitis, etc. And, of course, that study had adrenal tumours. So adrenal tumours played into that number.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. So tumours that had some sort of malignancy that grew into a vessel or something like that.
But right? But if we look at the study by, there was a non-euthanasia study by Nagata, a Japanese study in 2015. And I guess this will never be repeated because it's unlikely that we would have a non-euthanasia endpoint. I think one dog out of the whole study was euthanized. And that study showed that there was a really significant increase in survival time in dogs treated with trial stain versus dogs that were left untreated. So, again, it backs up the fact that this disease, which we've all regarded as almost being a luxury disease, well, you can treat it or you don't have to, is not really such a luxury disease. I mean, we're very keen to get in early on cardiovascular disease and all sorts of other diseases, but we still have this textbook reluctance to go after Cushing's.
And I know Prof. Dave Church talks about just neurologically, mentally also feeling shitty, which is hard to put your finger on it, but to go, yeah, people with it say that they don't feel well, they feel agitated, they feel yuck.
Absolutely. And I think this is, again, there's very little about this in the literature, but Dave and Steinneson and the RVC group with Imogen Schofield showed that the quality of life was really quite poor with Cushing's and that improved with treatment. Now, anything else in vet that had poor quality of life, we'd want to treat, but somehow, again, we have this reluctance with Cushing's. I mean, I'd rather risk Addison's any day and have an improved quality of life than prematurely age and get all the horrible quality of life issues that these dogs have. And you mentioned the mental things. We did a study with very tight control. It's still in preparation. It's not far off being submitted. But interestingly, out of the dogs that had anxiety, a bit over 25% of them actually had complete resolution of the anxiety with tight control of the Cushing's.
Really?
Yeah. And, I mean, some got worse. Some stayed the same. So it's not a panacea of anxiety, don't get me wrong, but it is one of the causes of anxiety. And if you control it tightly, these dogs resolve. I mean, I had a vet whose own dog had a thunderstorm phobia and had serious canine cognitive dysfunction. And those things essentially resolved or at least dramatically improved once we treated the Cushing's. So the mental aspects of this disease, which we've so long ignored, even though as vets we know that the owners come in really delighted that they've got a young puppy again sometimes after treatment, we just ignore these significant behavioural issues. And Dave Church has always been a very strong proponent, and as am I, that the polydipsia is a behavioural issue in these dogs. That USG, for example, it might be affected by a couple of 0.001, 0.002, 0.003, whatever, by the direct effects of corticosteroids on the nephron. But really what drives a dog to polydipsia, polyuria, is this incessant polydipsia. And they can turn it off in hospital, which they couldn't if it was a primary polyuria followed by a secondary polydipsia.
So if you take water away from them, then they can concentrate just fine. There's nothing wrong with the concentration. They're just crazy.
Yeah, they're crazy.
It kind of makes sense, though, if you think of it, because it's a stress hormone. If your body's artificially saying constantly, hey, we're in stress, get ready for action, get ready to fight or flight or do something, it would make sense that it would impact you neurologically. You're going to be anxious all day.
Absolutely. And when I was looking after putting this question in the survey and the study I did, there's a number of papers on PRED, and all the things they described on secondary effects of prednisolone in dogs were exactly the same as I had seen historically coming in on submission after submission after submission over 20 years through Vetnostics. Nocturnal restlessness, anxiety, vocalizing, thunderstorm phobias, aggression. They're all listed in pred papers. But again, that's sort of gone into the behavioral stream and it seems to have been separated out from the endocrine stream.
Yeah, right. I like it when I have a light bulb go because it's not something I've ever really thought about. You sort of put things in little boxes and those two boxes didn't really mix. So thank you. That's a good thing to think about. So you mentioned, we're back to testing and confirming this. So I think what that conversation did for me was to make sure that you think about it in more than just the screamingly obvious case. Put it on the list and talk to the owners about why you should chase the diagnosis. So you mentioned ALP, urine SG. Other common questions that people struggle with, or are those the two standouts?
Funny enough, the flip side is one of the most common questions. I have a dog that's completely normal, but I've watched its ALP go up every year on its wellness profiles, or I have a dog that's coming in for dental or something and it's got a really high ALP. Dog's completely normal, not drinking, whatever. What do I do? And that would probably be the most common question. Because, again, textbooks would suggest that you shouldn't go chasing these dogs for Cushing's. And how I address these is I obviously look carefully at the age, the breed, probe into all the clinical things I can assess from a distance because I don't have the dog in front of me, and discuss it with the vet. But often it comes down to these dogs have, if they don't have polyphagia, they at least have a robust appetite, nearly always.
That's what I'm going to say for myself from now on. It's a robust appetite.
And so do I, but I have to say I'm not crossing for it. So they have a really robust appetite. How many conditions that cause really high ALPs, and I mean, we're talking up to 9,000, 10,000, 12,000 units per litre, but it could also be 200 units per litre or 400 units per litre. But how many pathological conditions other than Cushing's cause these high ALPs, but still a dog that has come in completely healthy?
Yeah, I can only think of one. I can only think of the one. Are there any others?
Well, I guess there could. I mean, you could have, ALP can come from a number of areas, I suppose. You could have the bone tumour that hasn't yet manifest. You could have a cholestatic lesion that isn't at the stage it's causing obstruction. But then most of those vets then do the right thing and they've taken the dogs out to abdominal ultrasound and they still can't find any lesion to explain their ALP of 800, 900, 1,000 or worse, 10,000. And they have this healthy dog with a robust to increased appetite. And I'd say test for the reasons that Dave Church discusses, that I think it has a really significant quality of life effect and I don't need it to go to polydipsia and polyphagia and a potbelly and alopecia to make me want to treat it. I would point out that puts me at odds with nearly everyone else in the world.
We say hold off until it's clinical. Yep. Yeah, right. It is confusing talking about this disease because you're right, there are different opinions on it, but the way you describe it makes sense. If it was me, never mind my dog, if it was me, I'd probably want to know if there was something majorly wrong with my metabolism.
If I've had my own dog that I've thought has early Cushing's, I'd far rather get a diagnosis early and get onto it. I don't want it to rupture a cruciate or end up with pancreatitis. I don't want either of those things.
Did you have a Cushing or a dog?
I had a dog that I couldn't prove Cushing's. Which is just the complete irony. I mean, you know, I used to get stopped in the pub and asked whether my dog had mange, for God's sake. And it looked like it, smelt like it, tasted like it. I did ACTH DIM after low dose DEX after ACTH DIM after low dose DEX, T4s, CTSH, free T4s, you name it, I did it. And unfortunately, most of it was pre-trilestane. And I just started her on a trilestane treatment trial in desperation. And then she deteriorated with some neurological disease and I had to euthanize her. So I never got to do it in my own dog. But were I in the situation I am now, where I've done numerous treatment trials and have been involved in numerous treatment trials in dogs with ACTH DIM and low dose DEX test negative results, I would have actually given her a treatment trial. Yeah.
Okay. So if you say treatment trials, you mean in individual patients? Are you talking about trials on a research basis?
No. Well, we did incorporate the possibility of a treatment trial into the European Society of Veterinary Endocrinology ALIVE definitions. They basically state that if you've got double negative tests and you think that you have Cushing's and that the consequences of Cushing's will be life-threatening, that you could consider a treatment trial. I prefer to myself do them before complications become life-threatening. But that is at least, it now at least has a place in the literature, in the possibility of doing one is there.
And that is because you mentioned that you were involved in the consensus statement creation. Is that part of the consensus statement to say, look, if it looks and acts and smells like Cushing's and you can't find any other reason for it?
And it has a life-threatening consequence, which wasn't my addition, but, you know, this is a consensus statement. And some of them are. I mean, if you look at these dogs that are just incontinent all day, every day, that's really horrible for the dog and terrible for the owner. And if you've done test after test and they're negative, what have you got to lose? They're going to be euthanized for their incontinence. Putting them on a trialistane treatment trial, a cautious, well-managed treatment trial, you've got nothing to lose at all.
So what does a cautious, well-managed treatment trial look like?
Well, I guess it's not to be taken lightly. So the owners have to be fully counseled as to the things that you might make worse than they already are, that you could cause a life-threatening disease, you could cause Addison's. Me, I would always start on half the routine dose that I was using for that particular dog size, just to make sure they were going to tolerate the drug before I then made dose changes. Because obviously I want to get it into a range that I would expect to see clinical resolution of signs, otherwise I can't judge my treatment trial. But for that first 10 days, I put them on a reasonably low dose just to make sure that they can actually tolerate it. And in Australia, at least, and I do preface this as being Australian, we do have the option of using cortate, which is cortisone acetate, which is essentially identical to cortisol. And that means that I give those owners cortate at 1 mg/kg to take home. And if the dog even vaguely might have an adverse reaction or effect from the trialistane, I instruct the owners to give cortate.
So vaguely, what are they looking for? Your discharge instructions, look out for what?
I certainly don't want them to get to the stage of vomiting and diarrhea and collapse. So I'd rather get them that the dog didn't want to walk as well this morning. The dog seemed a little bit lethargic. Perhaps it wasn't quite eating as much as it should, which of course could be because it's responding to the trialistane. I'd rather see what happens adding in the cortate and assess the response, because dogs do respond very quickly to cortate. I've had dogs literally collapse that will get up within 30 to 45 minutes. So not with a treatment trial, I might add, but with normal treatment. If you're talking about other countries, your options are, I guess, to use PRED, but there's a 24-hour withholding on PRED before you do an ACTH stim, so that does make it a little bit long if you're trying to see what's happening with your trialistane. And the other possibility, if you don't mind giving it, I suppose, is DEX, because that doesn't cross-react with the cortisol assays. So you could get the owner to give DEX and then bring it in and do an ACTH stim assay to assess whether the dog is too tight or not without any weight on DEX. It's 12 hours on cortate, 24 hours on PRED and nothing on DEX. But, of course, cortate is virtually a physiological steroid. DEX and PRED are quite potent.
Okay, so you start your treatment trial, half a dose for about 10 days, you said. If during that period the dog's not well, it's sick, then you say, yeah, give it a steroid of sort, ideally cortate, come in, let's do an ACTH stim test. And if you are overzealously treating or treating where it didn't need treatment, you're going to have a flatline stim test, or what are they going
to
do?
I have to say, it almost, I'm going to jinx myself, but it's never actually happened to me in a treatment trial. So usually we're only doing treatment trials in dogs where vets, or me personally, are very sure that these dogs have Cushing syndrome and we can't prove it on the test. And again, the ALIVE consensus statement, so the ALIVE definitions for Cushing's, acknowledge the fact that there are problems with the sensitivity of the testing that we use for diagnosing Cushing's.
Okay, so flip side, you start on the dose, it's a half a dose, 10 days in, nothing really changes. But how are we monitoring? Because we just said that the test didn't give us the answer. Are we just looking at what the dog's doing? Like in that 10-day period, are you sort of not expecting improvement? You just want to make sure they don't fall apart.
Exactly. And your question is a really good one, and I get asked it a lot with treatment trials, of course. You still monitor with an ACTH stim because you still want to make sure that they're not going Addisonian. So it's really important that you monitor with an ACTH stim and don't just do it clinically so that you know that you're not going too tight. But the flip side is we all know that dogs have a huge different range of trilostone that's required for their Cushing syndrome control. We also can't measure their clinical response if we haven't got to a post-stim cortisol that at least would give control in a conventional dog. So for me, on the Vetnostics assay, I want dogs to be between 30 to 70 nanomoles per litre post-stimulation when the test is performed 4 to 6 hours after trilostone dosing. And I'd at least like it to be under 100. For most immunoassay assays, and I do consult on some immunoassay assays, probably between 40 and 100 post-stimulation. And I have to have it somewhere in that range before I can assess whether it's been effective to control the signs. Because if the dog is still stimulating to 250 or 300, then I don't expect any clinical resolution of a dog that's proved positive on an ACTH stim, low-dose Dex, or on negative on both.
Mm. So just to make it applicable for people who use a different lab, what sort of percentile of the range are we aiming for? So let's say the dog stimulated normally, but top end normal, but within the expected reference range pre-treatment. Now we're treating it. Where do we want to see it stimulate to? Like the bottom half or what?
As a generality, whatever the lab's reference interval for basal cortisol is, you don't want it stimulating any higher than that, at least.
For basal cortisol?
Basal cortisol. What we're aiming for is subclinical. What we're always aiming for in Cushing's treatment is healthy subclinical hypoadrenocorticism. We don't want to crash them. We just want to have a dog that has enough cortisol to live but can't be producing excess cortisol throughout that day. And the only way to do that is to ensure that after ACTH, it can't stimulate much higher than what the basal cortisol is for any given lab.
So a well-treated Cushing's patient will have lower cortisol levels even under stress than an untreated normal healthy animal.
Yeah, absolutely. And a well-controlled Cushing's dog, again, should have supplemental corticosteroids when it is enduring periods of stress. So when it's boarding, when it's going in for surgery, when it's having its GA. In order to make sure a dog doesn't have hypercortisolism, you really have to eliminate a stress response to a degree.
All right. So you can have enough cortisone to live, but not enough to actually be stressed. If you want more than that, I'm going to have to give it to you externally.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why Cortate, again, is very handy. So, I mean, Cortate, I would advise routinely for every trilostane treatment. Every single one. And then I tell owners that, well, you've got to be their adrenal gland. If you think they're going into boarding, give them 0.5 mg per kg of Cortate every day while they're boarding and just leave the trilostane the same and add in some Cortate. That will make sure they have enough stress to deal with it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other scenarios, but I'm thinking of my dogs. But I'm just realizing my dogs have the most stress-free lives in the world. Well, I don't think they need their adrenal glands.
The interesting thing is when I did my master's research back in the 90s, I had all these dogs that thought they were my pets. They were kept in very elaborate stables, not kennels. You know, they could see out. They had tables that were covered with hessian. You know, they were in the days pre anyone worrying about animal welfare, these guys had palatial accommodation and exercise and they thought they were my pets. And the vast majority of those dogs had basal cortisols that were less than 10 on the old radioimmunoassay all the time. And that's a situation we don't see or get to see in a clinic because an animal walks across the car park, they get cortisol increase in minutes, and so a basal cortisol measured at a vet clinic is quite different from my dogs, which were at home essentially. And so they were less than 10. It was astounding how low. And I found one other reference in the literature, a very old paper where they found, they just commented that well-conditioned research dogs had almost no basal cortisol. And so I don't think dogs need a lot of cortisol from day to day. They need it, of course, when they get sick, when they get stressed, when they're under behavioral stress, disease stress, just like we do.
Yeah, it's another shift that's happening for me in the last year or so is with several diseases, but this one of them. In my head, it used to be cortisol, you're going to have a level that's going to not fluctuate too much, almost like a blood glucose. You're going to sit there. But it's more like a diabetic blood glucose, but it's going to go up and down in response to whatever is happening. And we're just taking pinpoint at random locations when we just do non-stimulated blood cortisol levels.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Cushing's itself is defined by an overall accumulation of corticosteroids, a hypercortisolism that goes across days, months, rather than a single point. So it's not rare, I suppose, that we would see dogs that might have a basal cortisol of 30, 40, say on a low-dose Dex test, but they just don't suppress. So they go 40, 40, 40. Well, an average dog coming into a clinic might be 140. So a 40 per se isn't particularly exciting for a basal cortisol. But when that dog, if you take it at another time point, it might be 140, maybe it's 200, maybe it's 300. And it's how many fluctuations of cortisol in that day that add up to this cumulative pattern that we see that causes Cushing's. It's not just a single point cortisol.
Mm. That's really cool. So when we're doing those treatment trials and really just for treating the more obvious Cushingoid dog, at what point are we doing those ACTH stim tests to check response to treatment? How long after starting treatment and how frequently beyond that do we want to test them?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty rigid about follow-ups. I'd rather do more monitoring tests and control tighter. I want to check in 10 to 14 days. Unlike the DECRA recommendations, I will change the dose at 10 to 14 days based on the result, simply because my clients don't seem to have an endless supply of money to do ACTH stim testing time after time after time. So if I miss one opportunity to change a dose, that might mean another ACTH stim test, which in Australia could be anywhere between, you know, $500 or $600, depending on which clinic's running it. So I'll do 10 to 14. If I have it perfect, then I'll check it in 3 to 4 weeks to make sure it's stable, and then every 3 months. And I really don't variate very much off every 3 months monitoring. I'm quite happy just to run a post-stimulation cortisol, though. I don't necessarily run the 0 hour. And I think that's also really handy for those dogs that are really anxious. I'm happy to use IM or subcut ACTH and send the owners away, do it in the car park, send the owners away for a coffee for an hour and get them back and do my 1 hour blood draw. And that makes it a lot less stressful for some of these owners and their dogs. So I'm quite happy to make all sorts of compromises to make it work so that I can monitor as much as I want to. And that does, I guess, also when you were talking about ACTH stim versus low-dose Dex, there is a reason why general practitioners like the ACTH stim, because they have a dog in for 1 hour, not 8 hours. They don't have to get it in at 8 a.m. But also for really anxious dogs, I think it's a real advantage just to be able to do a modified ACTH stim test and not to even have the dog in hospital. See them in the car park, send them away, get them back in for a 1 hour blood draw. And who cares about the 0 hour?
Yeah, which makes sense. Well, what dose are you giving that IM, subcut dose? Just to make sure we all...
5 micrograms per kilo IM. I mean, I even had to use it on my neighbor's dog the other day because it was a miniature schnauzer and it was being slightly difficult and it jumped and it didn't want to do anything, of course, because it was a neighbor's dog. And half of it went IM, half of it went subcut. Fortunately, both have been validated for ACTH, and I just did a 1 hour blood draw and confirmed its Cushing's.
I'm just going to jump in here with a little post-recording edit. So after this episode came out on the Clinical Podcasts, Dr. Sue got back to me and said that she was aware that in a previous podcast episode with us talking about Cushing's, we had a fact out there that said that we should maybe not freeze synactin. She got back to me to say that that is incorrect. It it has been proven, it has been validated that you can store synactin safely up to 6 months. They just never tested it past 6 months, but we know that frozen up until 6 months, it is still going to be effective. So how would we do that? You would open the vial, draw out your dose and give it, and the remainder, you draw it into small aliquots, like 0.2 mils, or if you're going to be using the same vial for the same dog in future and you're billing that same vial to the animal, you draw it up in the dose that you're going to be needing for that animal in future. And then you put those little doses in the freezer and you can keep them frozen for up to 6 months, we know. And when you need to do your next test, you thaw it and use it immediately. Single thaw only, so don't refreeze it. So you can't freeze a whole vial, defrost it, draw some out, put it back in the freezer. Just that dose, thaw it, inject it, and then don't store it in the refrigerator. Dr. Sue says in her experience, what happens is we put it in the fridge to use later and we forget to use it. And it's definitely not validated for use once opened after storing just in the fridge. Hope that helps. You mentioned earlier, you said you will at 10 to 14 days, you will change your dose based on that stim result, unlike Dekra. So what does Dekra recommend?
They just recommend that you make sure that the dog isn't Addisonian at that time and keep on going and make any changes at the next test.
Whereas you'll look at the 10 to 14 day mark and go, no, that's still stimulating way too much, pop my dose.
If it's only just out, I won't bother changing it, because some dogs increase their trialostane requirements over time and some dogs decrease. So there is a reason for not changing at 10 to 14 days, but you know, a dog that's still stimulating to 500 is going to be stimulating any better in 3 weeks' time, that's for sure.
And then what increments do you increase your dose? Does it depend on the degree of the stimulation, or is it a standard, I'm up by 20% or 50% or what?
No, I literally will make the decision based on how high it's stimulating. I don't actually use milligrams per kilogram for my starting doses. I use empirical doses, which I've always used before that oral was even released as a drug, and we had trialostane as part of experimental work. And in those days, everyone did everything in the increments of 30, 60, 120, because that was all that was available in capsules. And I still find empirical dosing works for me, and I find it easy to juggle dose changes based on what dose they're already on as an empirical dose. I really don't care how many kilos they are.
Explain empirical dosing. So how do you dose? Let's say I've got a 20 kilogram dog and it's got Cushing's.
Okay, so a 20 kilo dog, probably 50 to 60 mgs BID.
And then a 10 kilogram dog?
10 kilo dog, 20 mgs, 20 mgs BID.
I'm trying to understand your thinking. If you say you're not using milligram per kilogram, so then how do you make your decision of your dose?
In the old days, all the original studies, anything less than 5 kilos or up to 5 kilos got 30 milligrams a day. That was when we were using once daily dosing. And then anywhere between 5 and 20 got 60 milligrams, and everything over 20 kilos got 120 milligrams. Now, I certainly think that in itself is a little bit too broad these days, knowing what we know, and large breed dogs, to be honest, can take almost nothing. So if I have a giant breed, a 50-kilo dog, I might start it on 30 milligrams once a day just to make sure it's not going to crash, you know, whereas we have Maltese that end up taking 180 milligrams BID for a 5-kilo dog. So it's not a linear scale for me, and that's why I don't like mgs per kg. That's why I wrote a letter to JAVMA. I think the only thing I've ever got into JAVMA, discussing a paper of Ed Feldman's on how I felt dosing wasn't related to kilos. It was more related to breeds and sizes, with some breeds particularly resistant. So the Maltese and the Maltese Shih Tzus and potentially the Yorkie Silkies being more resistant, and some of the giant breed dogs literally almost only have to open the bottle when they crash. So I just still use that scale. If I have a 5-kilo dog, I'll use 15. Now I use more BID, so I'll use 15 BID or 30 SID. 10-kilo dog, 40 milligrams or 20 BID. 15-kilo dog, up to 20, sort of almost on a linear scale. But once I go over 20, I look at how big the dog actually is and whether it's just one of those 20 to 25 kilo type dogs versus the giant breeds, which I really think can be really sensitive.
And you said your starting dose for those guys is?
No more than 30 mgs BID. I start really low. And greyhounds, I suppose, they're not really what I'd call a giant breed. Greyhounds seem to have a very good trialestein tolerance, which is always interests me. So I start them just like I would any 20 to 30 kilo dog. And plenty of greyhounds do get Cushings now they live long enough in Australia.
They're definitely worth things. Wow, okay. And then we chatted to, again, back to Dave Church, and he, well, there's some new developments in the space of treating Cushing's disease that he mentioned that I heard somebody else talk about the other day as well. Beyond trialestein, what's happening? What are you recommending or saying or seeing, or what's new?
Well, I guess there's a number of things in the pipeline, but none of them are yet here. So, and I'm a very clinical person and I don't have a lot of research capacity in my current job apart from looking crunching big numbers like I do. I think as soon as we can get rid of trialestein, the better it'll be. Sorry, doctor, but, you know, that's the way. it's a really difficult drug. It was supposed to be the panacea. It wasn't supposed to cause Addison's. I like the drug because I can, say, use it with my treatment trials, and I can use it in sick dogs that I was scared about using mitotane in. But overall, I don't think it's actually as good a drug as mitotane, and it's certainly a lot more expensive. And if I were doing a lot of clinical practice now, to be honest, I'd be going back to mitotane with what we have available, because I just think it's so much cheaper. You get a much more consistent effect. You have much less monitoring. A stable Cushing's on mitotane is every 6 months. And I know for many places in the world that's not an option, because you have to use the drug that's registered for treatment, which is fed oral. But in Australia, that's not the case. And a lot of our rural practitioners use mitotane very effectively because their clients simply can't afford trialestein. And I think if rural mixed practitioners can use mitotane successfully, then really it's an okay drug still.
So you can still get it? It's still available?
It's difficult in Australia. You have to get it through DECRA, interestingly. I'm sure they don't like the product. The APVMA won't register it here, so that's the Australian registering body, without a full set of drug registration data, which is just, to be frank, ludicrous. I mean, this drug's been around forever and we've used it forever, but in order to get registration, you'd have to do full trials, which no one's ever going to do on an old-fashioned drug. So that means they have some sort of provisional registration, and you actually have to apply to DECRA with the script. You can't get it through a wholesaler, and you get your mitotane through DECRA.
So if you had a Cushingoid dog now, especially if you actually could confirm it, not your one that was the unprovable Cushingoid dog, would you apply for mitotane?
Absolutely. I'm doing it for my neighbour's dog. They can't afford trialestein. I've found a local vet who's happy to go along with using mitotane for them. I'm talking about, it's actually my mother's neighbour, so in a different state. For large breed dogs, I still prefer trialestein. They used to crash with mitotane, and sometimes they never got up again, to be honest. So for the large and giant breed dogs, especially since a smaller mg per kg dose is often used, it's perfectly reasonable to use trialestein. But for the 5 to 10 kilo dogs, I'd be treating the majority with mitotane.
Because I've never actually used it, I know we learnt about it, but I can't quite remember what it actually does. So the difference is trialestein, it's a temporary suppression of cortisone production. I know there's some theory that sometimes there can be hemorrhage in the adrenal cortex and it can actually cause permanent changes. But whereas mitotane, you actually take out the adrenal cortex. Is that right, or what does it do?
No, it's a chemotherapeutic drug. So it causes adrenocorticolysis, and you can either use it selectively to try and sort of just shave off enough of the cortex to produce the right amount of cortisol, or you can wipe it out completely and just treat them as Addison's. And for those of us that are old enough that have used a lot of mitotane, inadvertently we do end up with Addison's, of course, on mitotane, and those owners always seem to be much happier. And you can ask almost any old vet and they'll go, yeah, that dog that I cooked the adrenals, it did much better. Because Addison's is relatively easy to treat and Cushing's is really quite hard to treat. And that goes along with Dave Church. I'm sure you've discussed this with Dave Church. His preference is to surgically remove both adrenals. I'm not as brave as that, and I've seen things go wrong with surgery, but I'd be more than happy to ablate adrenals, and I've advised on protocols, again, mainly in rural areas where people have a lot of trouble coming back and forth to the clinic to get rechecks because they might have to travel 300 Ks. Each way. And a number of rural clinics have managed the non-selective adrenocorticolysis protocol very easily and very effectively, and the dogs just stay on Cortate and Florinef or Cortate and Percortin for the rest of their lives.
And then how much do you know about there was a talk that I listened to recently about scooping out the pituitary gland for the pituitary dependent. Is that something we're aware of at all?
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan, I guess. For me, it seems a rather drastic treatment for Cushing's to end up with hypothyroidism, central diabetes insipidus, Addison's and dry eye, you know, just to swap for Cushing's. And not to mention, we're talking a surgery that probably costs somewhere between $25,000 and $30,000. I also have another theoretical problem with it, and I don't know because I haven't been involved in these programs, but certainly when I was in the Netherlands, the comment I heard was that most dogs that live 5 years with their Cushing's, even with a hypophysectomy, will need a second one.
Because it regrows again.
Yeah, I don't know that many people have got 60,000 dogs, and we have, especially in Australia where we have a high Maltese population in our Cushing's population, they have quite young ages of presentation, so it's not so uncommon to get a Maltese coming in at 3, 4, 5. I mean, 3, not so much, but 4-year-old, 5-year-old Maltese. And they're still sometimes alive at 17. So if they had a hypophysectomy at 4, they would need another one again at 9 and another one again at 14, if that's right. And as I say, I don't know because I've never been involved with those programs, but it was a comment that I was given at Utrecht that it's not a permanent solution if a dog actually lives long enough. Now, they may have refined that since then, I don't know, but it's not something I would ever do on my own dog. Well, I couldn't do it anyhow because I wouldn't have the skills, but it's not something I would refer my own dog to have done. I just don't see that having a hypothyroid Addisonian dog with central diabetes and also on DDAVP as well and dry eye is really what I want for my patient.
No, no. Are we missing anything? There's a lot to think about there and a lot of shifts and a lot of deeper understanding. This is why we talk to specialists.
It's probably all really controversial, but it's just the different take because of the numbers game.
No, I love it. This is what we try and get to because these diseases are complicated and it helps to... I actually kind of like having different opinions on the podcast because in the end, we have to make our own decisions as clinicians. It's nice to speak to people with opinions and then you can formulate your own idea. Are we missing anything, Sue?
There probably is one comment I'd like to make.
Yeah.
One take home. There's only been one study of survival rates in GP hospitals, and it was done in Britain on Vet Compass data, and it was pretty woeful, like 500 days or something. We've just finished an Australian study where these dogs were controlled really tightly, so to the vetnostics between 30 and 70 post-stim, and they've knocked the survival figures in the literature out of the ballpark. Now, that could be because of our population. It could be our different breeds. It could be all sorts of things. We might have longer living breeds. I'm not claiming that it's due to the tight control of Cushing's. But what it does say, and these dogs were all in general practice. They weren't referral practice. So compared to all the other referral studies out there. So they were managed by GPs, admittedly with help in some cases, from vetnostics consultants. But within that oversight and within that framework, we managed to have really long survivals, which is pretty exciting because it means that GPs are managing these well, they're managing them tightly, and they're managing them safely, and they have long survivals. And I think that's a real take-home message because I think GPs are often assumed not to manage as well as specialists, something that I think is a little bit arrogant, but anyhow, that GPs can manage these well. They have good client relations, and if they have the right support, tight control, Cortate in the cupboard, then these dogs can have very long survival times with very good quality of life.
So do you think the woeful survival times in the previous study was because we were being too pussyfooting around the disease and trying so hard not to make them Addisonian that we didn't really treat the Cushing's effectively?
Yeah, I do think that's the case. And I do think the veterinary profession as a whole is obsessed with the avoidance of Addison's. I mean, Addison's is really easy to treat and pancreatitis is not. A ruptured cruciate is not. Getting calcium oxalate urolithes is not. Pulmonary thromboembolism can kill them. I'm not quite sure why our risk analysis is so skewed onto one disease that we can all treat. Sure, it might make the dog sick, and yes, it can be life-threatening, but much less life-threatening if we're expecting it, anticipating it, and have steps in place to prevent it, than all these things that I can't control with uncontrolled Cushing's. I can't stop them getting pancreatitis. And the saddest case for me ever is a dog that was actually diagnosed and was under specialist control in Germany. And one of my colleagues there said, why don't you ring Sue? That dog got Cushing's myotonia on recommended DECRA control rates. And that is tragic, because that dog lived another 5 or 6 years with a totally dedicated owner with a terrible condition that is not reversible in any way, shape or form. Cushing's pseudomyotonia is not reversible. And yet if that dog had been controlled tightly, hopefully it would never have got there in the first place. So I just think our risk assessment is wrong.
I'll hazard a guess. I think it's a psychology thing in that as a liable professional, whatever happens because of your dog's cushionoid isn't my fault. It's the cushion's fault. So if you get a cruciate or something, I didn't cause that. Whereas if I give your dog Addison, I did that. So is there a question about whether it's genuine liability or the feeling of liability of saying, well, I don't want to first do no harm. I suspect that's probably it.
It absolutely is it. And often I get vets saying to me, but, you know, I don't want to, I mustn't do no harm. But lack of treatment efficacy is not do no harm either.
Yeah, hopefully this episode will shift that perception.
but yeah, it is. And I mean, I totally understand where people are coming from, and I also understand that it's a major textbook shift and it's what's driven whether we even treat Cushing's or not. But I just think we need to look better at the risk analysis.
Yeah, it sounds like a communication thing, just finding a way to communicate this in a succinct way to an owner to say, is we are going to tangle with this other disease, but here are the reasons. If I overstep the line, this is what it's going to look like. But if I undertreat, this is what it's going to look like. Which way do you want to go?
Yeah, I think that's really right. And I don't think we do that at the moment. And it should be that whole holistic concept. You know, I could cause this life-threatening disease, but you could get a life-threatening disease anyhow if you don't treat. And so I think it is a matter of communication. And at least in Australia, as I say, we have cortate in the cupboard, and I often take the extra step of writing in red on it, antidote. which Dave Church used to actually do with Pred and Mitotane, for what it's worth. So I learned from the master, and it's helpful. When owners know they have the antidote in the cupboard, they reach for the antidote.
That's cool. Marketing. It's called marketing.
It is. It's total marketing.
Sue, that was magic. Thank you so, so much for your time.
Thank you for having me on here.
If you liked that episode, then you will love our clinical podcast series. For the clinical podcast, we split that recording that you just listened to into 20-odd minute episode so that you can listen to it in one commute or one walk around the block or one load of dishes without getting total information overload. And we've put the show notes in a brand new, fully searchable network that is exclusive to our subscribers. So if you wanted to look up the dose of trilistane, for example, or what Dr. Sue said about ACTH stim testing, or anything else from our almost 400 episodes of content in small animal medicine, surgery, and emergency and critical care, you'll get a list of all of the relevant show notes and episodes. Try it now for free for 2 weeks at vvn.supercast.com. And don't do it just for your patients. Do it for yourself, because competence breeds confidence, and confidence is king.